Hi, everyone. So next talk, we have Diomedis Spinelis here, who will speak to us about how they found the V4 tape and uploaded that in the Unix history repo.
Thank you. Hello, good morning. As you know, Unix has defined the way modern computing works. It was developed in the world-famous AT&T Bell Laboratories. That is a place associated with no less than 8 Nobel Prizes and 3 Turing Awards. And yet it started its life out of a failure. AT&T, General Electric, and MIT were building a system called Multics in the 1960s that was a bit too ambitious for the capabilities of the time. So AT&T pulled out of the project. It wasn't going too well. And Ken Thompson and other scientists found themselves without a subject of studies. So Ken Thompson, later joined by Doug McIlroy, Jeff Osana, and Dennis Ritchie, went on and developed first an unnamed system on a PDP-7. It has some very interesting ideas in it. And based on the success of that system, they created a funding proposal to Bell Laboratories. They needed to do that even in that well-funded place for a more powerful computer. Initially, they asked for a PDP-10, which cost about $500,000 at the time. Bell Labs stalled at the cost, and at the end they got a PDP-11, which cost a tenth of that price, and maybe the lesser capabilities of that system influenced the direction of Unix. Over the 1970s, a large group of people, you see them here at a later age, they were very young and powerful at the time, they developed on and created a series of Unix editions. These were numbered following the editions of the manual that came out each time. In various states, you see here the 7th so-called Bell Labs Research edition, from the 1st one to the 7th one. So source code was not versioned. Even at the last edition, there was no version control system. But the manuals were versioned through their printing and adding an edition word on it. Not a lot has survived from the first edition. So for the first unnamed one, it has survived in printed form, and people have OCR'd it in order to make it run. In others, when you see, we have some parts of commands, some parts of the kernel. At the fourth edition, we had just the documentation. Which brings me to 1974 and this letter from Ken Thompson to Martin Newell at the University of Utah, which says that we are delaying the delivery because we ran out of copies of the documentation, but they will soon send you the system. Newell, you might know him, is the person, a British-born computer scientist specializing in computer graphics. He's the creator of the famous Utah T-Port, a benchmark used for 3D rendering. So it seems at some point there was a version that could be shipped from Bell Labs to Utah. And something like this tape is a replica, and it's not the original tape, but I want to show it to you for those who are not familiar with the computer tapes, got shipped from Bell Labs to Utah. Fast forward to 28th of July 2025, and the storage closet of Robert Ritchie's Flux Research Group at the Merrill Engineering building you see here, where Alex Marek, a research associate in the group, found the tape among the documents of Jay LePro. The findings was widely reported, even on broadcast TV. So was there anything on the tape? It was important to read it, but also it was one tape. We never had access to it before, so it was considered very valuable. So to avoid high-altitude cosmic radiation on flights and airport scanner damage, lab members Joe Durick, that you see at the center, and Thalia Archibald, you see on the left, undertook an 11-hour drive to the Computer History Museum in California. There, it was read by archivist Al Kossoff of BitSavers, a famous archiving site. You see him here at work. To minimize tape wear, he used a system developed by computer historian Len Shashek. So he first read the tape, not as digital bits, but as a 1.6 gigabyte of analog data using a multi-track analog to digital converter. This means that a lot of hardware that you see here on the left that happens inside, that is implemented normally inside tape readers, can be implemented in software, and thereby the tape can be virtually read again and again with various settings so that it can be restored. You see here the waveforms from various tape tracks, and here I zoomed in to see how they can be seen and various elements, how they can be adjusted. This was successful, and now if you go to archive.org, using Schustek's read tape program, this 1.6 gigabyte analog data were converted on 2.5 megabytes of digital TAP format, which is compatible with the CMH emulator, and both are now available on archive.org. Think of it, the tape is 2.5 megabytes, about the same as a single picture we take with our mobile phones. What's the legal status of this tape? Thankfully, in 2002, Caldera, which owned the IP rights to Unix at the time, wrote this letter, which if you squint well enough,